Today is Thursday, August 31st. We're going to wrap up blood information and move into cardiovascular.
Okay, so for our first question for blood typing review, what blood type carries both an A and an Rh antigen?
A positive.
Good. Is there any other that carries those two antigens?
AB positive.
Yeah, AB positive also carries those two antigens, but yeah, you're right to say A positive because that's the most obvious answer here. Let's see, what type is considered the universal donor?
O negative.
O negative, good. And why is the universal donor term not entirely accurate? What does that person carry in the blood plasma?
Antibodies,
yeah. So O carries anti-A and anti-B antibodies, that's right. So whoever you give that whole blood to now gets your antibodies, which potentially could attack your own blood. Small risk, but you know, nonetheless.
Is that an O positive and a negative?
It would be, let's see, if you've got O negative, you would have anti-A, B, and Rh antibodies. If you are O positive, then you would have just anti and B, yeah. And not everybody has anti-Rh antibodies, only you get that through exposure or through pregnancy, yeah. Let's see, we're looking for a blood type that has A and B antigens, but no Rh factor.
AB negative.
Good, AB negative. All right, so the plasma of one blood type could carry, well actually more than one, could carry anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Could be O negative, could be O positive, yeah. Okay, so you know, it just depends on that exposure, whether or not you have developed those anti-Rh antibodies. All right, what kinds of blood types can A positive receive?
A negative.
Good, I didn't hear anybody saying anything about B, which is what I'm listening for. So yeah, A positive, A negative, O positive, O negative, but nothing with B because this person has what?
B antibodies,
right, they would fight that B antigen. What blood types can O positive receive?
O positive.
Good, O positive and O negative. So we're kind of limited there in terms of what O people can get. All right, so would you recommend giving O positive cells, not the plasma, just the blood cells to a person with B positive blood?
Yes.
It doesn't have the antibodies.
No, it doesn't matter.
If both of them, I can't hardly see if both positive.
Both are positive.
And if you're just giving the cells, you don't have to worry about the possible B antibody.
That's right. So if you're giving just the cells, B positive has seen the Rh factor. So that's all you're giving that person is your Rh factor as an O positive person. And you're right. If you're not giving plasma, you're not worrying about those antibodies. So this is a completely compatible transfusion, okay? Let's see, we've got now this time a whole blood transfusion of B positive to the AB positive person. AB to B. So AB positive to B, what you think?
No.
A antigens.
Yeah.
Actually, when you deal with whole blood, that whatever your blood type, that's the only blood that you can receive from is your own blood type, right?
If you're talking whole blood, your own blood type is the best compatible. Yeah. And possibly a negative type. Like if you're B positive, then B positive and B negative would be good ones.
As long as it doesn't have the Rh factor. Well, if you're receiving it from them, you get the same.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see, would you recommend giving a transfusion of B-positive whole blood to a person with AB-positive blood?
Yeah, you could.
Okay, so cell-wise, yeah. Well, antigen-wise, is this okay? So, there's two issues here, right? Antigen-wise, we're okay, because B-positive and AB-positive, well, B-positive has the antigen for B and the antigen for Rh, and that's what AB-positive has. So we're not introducing antigens that are foreign. It's the antibodies, right? So if you're talking the whole blood, what antibodies does B positive carry? An A antibody, right? So that is the only issue here, is that we have to be considerate of that small risk of giving the AB positive person some anti-A antibodies.
So whenever it's not the same blood type, do they take the plasma out and just give the blood cells? Like if it looks a case like that?
In this case, they might look for perhaps the same blood type if they can, or just give it and then deal with the aftermath later. Because if it's an emergency, they'll just give what they've got and just deal with any agglutination. Any agglutination that occurs would be a small risk anyway.
So the answer is yes, you can do that.
Yes, you can.
Okay, yeah. You just
be worried about the A antibodies.
Right. I mean, it's just, it's yes, you can. The antigens are compatible. It's just like a disclaimer that says, but there's this anti-A antibody. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense? Okay. So if you had that as a test question, you could say, yes, you can, and the reason why is because the antigens are compatible, but, you know, there's this... Yeah. Be mindful of it. Yeah, there's a small issue that we have to be concerned about. Yeah.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm getting confused.
Okay.
Okay, you will give B plus, will be positive whole blood to a person with AB plus. Okay, AB positives are, it has the, okay, what are the antibodies now?
B has
C plus.
I'm talking about AB.
AB has
none, right? Okay, so when the person that is giving the blood, that's what antibody you look at, right? So that the giver.
The first thing we look at is the antigen compatibility. Antigen wise, we're good. And then you have to say, okay, is there any issue with antibodies in the blood plasma of the donor? And
of the donor, okay.
And there is.
Okay, that's what, okay.
So, you know, you'd say, well, it's compatible antigen-wise, but there's this issue here with that anti-A antibody.
Okay.
Okay.
So if it was vice versa,
yeah.
If AB positive was given to B positive, it would be no, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Because you're now giving an A antigen that is not compatible.
Okay.
Yeah. How about O positive blood cells to a person who is AB positive?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good, right? Mm-hmm. You're not introducing any foreign antigens here. Okay, so cell-wise, antigen-wise, we're good to go. Let's see. This time, this is kind of what you were talking about, Kanika's giving AB positive whole blood to A positive.
Yes.
Okay, so antigen-wise, are we compatible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I introduce B antigen to the A person?
No.
So that right there kills it, right? Mm-hmm. So ideally, this is not the best transfusion. Okay. I hope this didn't confuse you. I hope it cleared up some points with transfusions. We can do another round of this come Tuesday if you like. We can also go through endocrine. Maybe we can do a little... quiz question game show through endocrine on Tuesday just to make sure we're staying fresh. Okay, why don't we finish up the content? Ashley.
So the antibody is always in the blood.
Correct.
And the antigen is always attached to the record.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do y'all have any questions on old stuff? Stuff we covered in here on Tuesday or even last week? Looks like we were in kind of getting into talking about granulocytes and agranulocytes in here on Tuesday. So why don't we go back and wrap up that topic?
What page is that?
That is top of page 25. let's just start from the beginning there with neutrophils. We know that neutrophils are the most common type of white blood cell. All right, so that makes up around 70% of the population of our white blood cells. What are some things that you can use to spot and distinguish a neutrophil from other types of white blood cells? The color, good. So what color would we expect to see the granules here?
Purple.
Yeah, pale purple, pale pink, even a pale blue color. Okay. How about the nucleus shape? Kidney shaped, good. You'll notice there's three lobes to that kidney-shaped nucleus. That's pretty classic neutrophil nucleus shape, so that's something to look for. So in terms of jobs in the body, what do neutrophils do for us?
Eat bacteria.
Eat bacteria, right. I believe we talked in here a little bit in class on Tuesday about sometimes if you have an illness and you're prescribed antibiotics, sometimes we go home and we take those drugs and we don't feel any better, so we end up back in the doctor's office. And if they can't figure out what's going on, a complete blood count where they break out all those white blood cells can give us an idea. Sometimes people have hidden sinus infections. Sometimes it's a UTI that doesn't present with any symptoms. But if we know that there is an increased level of neutrophils, now we know we've got a bacterial infection going on somewhere inside the body. All right, so here's a pretty neutrophil. This one does have the light colored granules like we would expect to see. You know, on average, these white blood cells are bigger than red blood cells, so by comparison, yeah, that seems to fall out to be true. All right, so the next on the list is an eosinophil. What color do their granules typically stain?
Orange, red, dark
green. Yeah, orange, red, bright pink. And in contrast here to your neutrophil, you definitely see some very bright colored granules in those eosinophils. Also, if you can see the nucleus for an eosinophil, how many lobes this time?
Just two.
Just two, yeah. So if you're looking at these granulocytes and you're saying, I don't know if I can tell the difference between them, keep in mind that neutrophils typically have three lobe nuclei, eosinophils typically have a two lobe nucleus. So if the color thing is throwing you off, do use the nucleus to help guide you. All right, so what do eosinophils fight?
Parasites
like worms and allergies. Okay, so let's define an allergy. You know, we talk about your body's making antibody against an antigen, and that's a normal response to a foreign invader. What an allergy is a ramped up abnormal response to an invader. So maybe you've been exposed to protein in shrimp, or maybe, you know, say peanut proteins, maybe a bee sting that's introduced something into your body. Those are normal antigens, and in some people, the immune system says, oh, woohoo, this is really bad, ramp up production of antibodies or ramp up production of the immune system and go haywire trying to fight it. So, you know, when we're talking about fighting off something that's foreign, you know, allergies are not the normal way for us to respond to something that's invaded our bodies. So eosinophils, we do think, are responsible for triggering that allergy response. And also basophils play a role in the allergic reaction or immune response as well. What do basophils make?
Histamine.
Yeah. So speaking of basophils, let's take a look at them. They have what colors of granules? Blue, purple, good. And there are so many brightly colored granules here in the basophil that we can hardly see the nucleus. But if you were able to make it out, it would be a two or a three lobe nucleus. Boy, talk about messing with you, right? So what I would look for the basophil are those really brightly colored blue or purple granules. That's probably your best clue that you've got a basophil. By the way, these are the least common of our white blood cells. So if you've ever had an itchy bite from a mosquito or perhaps any other kind of inflammation that occurs, we oftentimes, you know, think of that as a very uncomfortable situation, and we may place an antihistamine on there like some Benadryl cream. antihistamine medications work by blocking the histamine release from these basophils. So itchy, watery eyes, sneezy noses in the springtime, all that comes from histamine from your basophils. Now, what they tend to do is they make your blood vessels leak, so the fluid that makes your blood pressure actually leaks out into the surrounding cells and tissues. Unfortunately, if a lot of your basophils release their histamine granules quickly, all your vessels become leaky and your fluids leak out into the interstitial spaces. What happens to your blood pressure when this happens?
Decreases,
and you have a type of shock now known as anaphylactic. Yeah, so interesting that the least common blood cell of all can actually kill us by promoting anaphylactic shock.
Do you mind going back and explaining
the
nucleus?
In this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so your eosinophil, this is two lobes here. And your neutrophil should have, there's one, two, and three lobes.
Okay, I just saw like one thing up there, so I was confused by
it. It looks, but, yeah.
I see.
I'd say that's probably your marking point.
Okay.
Yeah. And by the way, we did skip over this one. It's a really pretty eosinophil. It's got wonderful colored granules in there. So this is your ideal picture, right, for an eosinophil. That's not the kind of picture you want to see on the test, right? Something that's questionable. No, don't mess with me like that, right? Okay. So if you have an infection, what might you have high levels of? Neutrophils, exactly. Good. All right. And so let's talk about agranulocytes. They tend to lack granules, although there may be a few in the cytoplasm. Overall, we don't see the mass amount of granules that we saw with the granulocytes. Lymphocytes and monocytes fall into this category. Lymphocytes tend to be rather large cells with a big round nucleus. Okay, so they are hard to mistake for something else. Big round cells, nice round nucleus. And these are the cells that make antibodies. They make antibodies. The antibodies now circulate in your blood plasma. And of course, those antibodies are present in case you do encounter something else that you've already been exposed to. This kind of looks like a lymphocyte, but let me draw your attention to the nucleus shape. The nucleus shape for a monocyte looks like a Pac-Man. You'll notice how it has an indentation in there, kind of kidney-shaped in a way. That indentation is what helps to differentiate a lymphocyte from a monocyte. So that's what I would look for to say, okay, I've got myself a monocyte this time. You'll notice what a really big cell this one is. It can travel through your bloodstream. It can go across the wall of your blood vessel. That process of walking across your vessel is called what?
Diapedesis,
good. And so it can go out to the site of an infection, and at that point, it transforms into a really big eating machine called a macrophage. And so it eats up debris, bacteria. It's kind of like a cleanup machine that comes to the site of an injury in your body.
Do all of the phagocytes have full mounts?
That might be one way to think of it, yeah, because neutrophils are eaters, so are eosinophils, monocytes. That might be a way to look at it. They've got a munchy mouth, yeah, that would be a way to look. You guys have probably heard the phrase, never let monkeys eat bananas. Okay, so most common to least common white blood cells, and of course your neutrophils are most common, your basophils are the least common. But let's put this in perspective. In terms of the overall most common blood cell in your body, that is what? Red blood cell, yeah. And ranked number two, platelets. Okay, and then so your neutrophils would be the third most common, Then, of course, lymphocytes, fourth most common. And then we've got, you know, all the way down to the basophils there, which are the absolute least common cells in your entire body in terms of blood cells. Okay. How about questions on those types of white blood cells? Anything you need help with for lab? Let's talk about platelets. They're down there near the bottom of your page. And a fancy word for a platelet is a thrombocyte. But that's kind of a misnomer because they're not actually true cells at all. They're cell fragments. And so it is their job to clot blood. That's really their only function. And because they are cell fragments, they really can't repair themselves. That's why they only last about 10 days in circulation, and then they're removed from circulation by your spleen. All right, so bottom of your page down there, normal platelet count in blood is about 150,000 to 350,000. And the lifespan, very bottom line, is around 10 days. So you notice up here it says that these thrombocytes form from the rupture of a really large cell called a megakaryocyte. If you break that word down, what is mega?
Large.
Big or large, good. And then kary? Nucleus. Yeah. So a big multinucleate cell called a megakaryocyte ruptures and gives rise to the platelets in your red bone marrow. I kind of have a mental image of blowing up a balloon and keep blowing until it pops. And what you now have are these little shards of balloon fragments all over the place. That's kind of what we think of in terms of platelet fragments. They're just little pieces that have come off of this really big cell, this megakaryocyte. And that is one there in the center of the picture. This is it in your bone marrow, and it's surrounded, it looks like, by a bunch of different white blood cells. But boy, it is huge in comparison to those other cells. So they describe it as like losing, you know, fragments that kind of drift off all the time. And of course, those platelets are placed into circulation where they can clot blood. But you know, 10 days is about the lifespan for something that is really a brainless, organelle-less piece of cell fragment. And so in this picture, you can see the tiny platelets in the background there. These things that look like little tiny specks of dust, those are the platelets. Hey, for fun, what kind of white blood cell is this one?
Lymphocyte.
Lymphocyte, good. And this one?
Neutrophil.
And this one?
Neutrophil.
Another neutrophil. And probably this one? Neutrophil. So when you think about never let, there's your neutrophils or your lymphocytes. So that's kind of what you'd expect to see in terms of commonality in the bloodstream.
Are lymphocytes the ones that increase lymphoma, like leukemia?
They can, but somebody may have all levels of white blood cells increase if they've got leukemia. It just depends on where in that stem cell progression that we start to see immature ones being pumped out into the blood circulation. But that is a common one. Yeah. Because it's like usually a lymphocytic type problem, yeah. So kind of a cool picture here. The red blood cell, of course, looks like the squished donut on the left. And you can see the platelet here and then the white blood cell over there. All right, so instead of going to blood clotting next, why don't we talk about blood cell disorders? They are on page 26. So we're going to use our vocab information here. The first set of blood cell disorders we're going to look at are called anemia and polycythemia. That prefix of A means what?
Without.
Without, right. And how about poly as a prefix?
Many.
Yep. So when we're looking at these two blood disorders, they are considered red blood cell disorders. Anemia is a red blood cell disorder that means we have some difficulty transporting adequate oxygen to the body. And anemia comes in many different forms. You may have, say, a sickled cell anemia from a genetic disorder. We may look at iron deficiency. So there's a whole vast number of types of anemia. We're just going to focus on a few here. So technically, we look at hemoglobin content, we look at iron content, we look at the ability to transport oxygen when we're looking at anemia.
Is there a reason anemia is more common in women?
Menstrual cycles. That's primarily it. Yeah. What they say is some women sit kind of on the borderline of being normal in terms of their blood content and iron content, and all it takes is heavy menstrual flows that can drop them down below that, what your body thinks is an acceptable range. Yeah. Thank you, body. Polycythemia is an excess condition of having too many red blood cells. We actually see two conditions causing this. Life at a higher altitude can promote polycythemia, and also bone marrow cancer can induce, you know, high levels of red blood cells being pumped out into circulation. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Good. I don't know if you can tell, but each one of these red blood cells has a very slightly spiky appearance, and that is because of the lack of iron that is used to make the heme and the hemoglobin molecules inside those red blood cells. So that is characteristic of seeing someone with iron deficiency anemia. And like we were talking, women are more at risk for this, primarily due to menstrual cycles. Heavy menstrual flows can reduce the blood volume, and sometimes women can never catch up, you know, to get their iron levels or hemoglobin levels back to normal. So iron deficiency anemia is a widespread problem for women, more so than for men, basically due to that menstrual cycle. And even after women finish menopause later in life, they may still have iron deficiency anemia because they've never been able to catch up and get those iron levels back up. How would you feel with this condition?
Tired.
Yeah. Another form of anemia is called sickle cell anemia. We know very well how this one is passed from one generation to the next, and it's carried on a recessive allele. So you could have a parent that does not demonstrate full-blown sickle cell anemia. That person could simply be a carrier. You could have another parent who also is a carrier. That's all it takes to have a child born with full-blown sickle cell anemia. So the parents could have the trait and be carriers for the disorder. There's a 25% chance that one child could be born with that complete full-blown disorder. So in addition to being tired, what are some other issues with having blood cells shaped like that traveling through your bloodstream?
Pain and blood
clots. Pain, inflammation, fever. What else? Low blood pressure. Okay, so this is a far more debilitating disease than, say, iron deficiency anemia, because we're working with blood cells that are shaped like little daggers floating through your bloodstream. I mean, that shape there does not go well through tiny capillaries, nor does it lend itself to transporting adequate oxygen. Just wanted to mention, did you have a question? Genetically, no. I mean, until they find a way to make the hemoglobin the right shape, right now there's not a cure for that particular anemia. Just want to mention this one. We know that B12 is an important ingredient used in making red blood cells. So this is what we call vitamin B12 deficiency anemia. It's called pernicious anemia. And interesting, we're going to learn later on that there's a link between your stomach and intestines and the absorption of vitamin B12. So if you've got problems absorbing B12 through your gut, then we can then see B12 not be available for those red blood cells to be manufactured. All right, on the other end of the scale, we have polycythemia. On the picture here on the left, you've got excess cells and being pushed out into circulation. What do you think an easy treatment is for somebody who has too many red blood cells?
Give blood.
Yeah, donate. Yeah, so about every 2-3 weeks or so, people with red blood cells in excess simply can donate blood, just have it pulled out of their body, and that can lower the viscosity or thickness of their blood. So why would life at a high altitude induce polycythemia?
Less oxygen.
Less oxygen, good. How long would it take to get to this point of having extra red blood cells? How long does it take to make new red blood cells? Yeah, something like 3 to 5, 3 to 7. So we can be generous and say, what, a week? And you're going to start seeing extra red blood cells in circulation. And if this was a permanent move that you came to a higher altitude, then you would just have normally higher levels of red blood cells. So if you suddenly came down to the low levels where we live here, and you had your blood tested, they'd say, oh, whoa, you've got polycythemia. But you'd say, hey, but I live up in the altitude, you know, 3,000, 5,000 feet, and that would be normal for living life at that elevation. Let's talk about some white blood cell disorders. If you've noticed on the news, on the internet, there's a new treatment out right now for leukemia, and there's a company in New Jersey called Novartis that has come out with basically you treat yourself with your own immune system kind of therapy for leukemia. They actually extract some of your own white blood cells. They genetically program them to attack the leukemia in your body, those cancerous cells, and it has put 83% of the patients with leukemia into remission. And so they're really excited about this because, you know, cancer has been a very hard disease to treat. And they say, well, maybe we can expand this out into other kinds of cancers. So they're really excited about what this potentially can do for other cancers, not just leukemia. The kind of person they were treating were kids with a form of leukemia called ALL. It's acute lymphocytic leukemia. And a lot of these kids were basically on death's doorstep. They had exhausted all the treatment options out there available to them, and this was their last hope. So, you know, that's certainly exciting news that we may have a tool that can fight, you know, at least one cancer successfully. The problem with leukemia, it's a bone marrow cancer, and what that means is somewhere in that lineage of those stem cell lines, we're going to start seeing immature cells being pumped out into circulation. And when a person has leukemia, it may not just be immature white blood cells that are pumped out. It may also be immature red blood cells. So we may say, well, hey, you've got this problem with your white population, and you also have immature red blood cells that can't handle oxygen transport. So it's not just a contained issue. It can be a far-reaching issue if you have leukemia. Leukopenia is another issue there that comes from having a depressed or a low white blood cell count. Let me take you back and think about corticosteroids for just a moment. Another name for corticosteroid is glucocorticoid. What was the example of that hormone group we talked about? Cortisol, right? You're right, and it regulates sugar, okay? And we talked about cortisone and cortisol as having an anti-inflammatory effect. Well, when you come full circle, the job of cortisone and cortisol is to suppress your immune system and not let your immune system do its job properly. And so if we're taking corticosteroids, we may actually have a reduced white blood cell count. Now, what is the issue for that? What if you have low white blood cell populations? Greater risk for infection, exactly. So, you know, certain people who have had organ transplants and now on a round of corticosteroids, you know, they have to be careful who is sick around them because they have no real defense mechanism. Yeah. Let's see, the next one there is Epstein-Barr virus. It can cause infectious mono. They call this the kissing disease, but that's not the only way you can catch it. If you live in an apartment or in a dorm room with other people and you happen to share drink glasses or exchange fluids in that way, then you can catch this Epstein-Barr virus that can infect your monocytes. What are your monocytes doing for a living?
They're your immune system response.
They're part of your immune system response. They eat bacteria and viruses. And if they eat the Epstein-Barr virus, it's really tough to kill. And so we're not necessarily going to get rid of the virus. We just want to suppress it, make it dormant. Yeah. So if your immune system can't conquer with antibodies that particular virus, then you may be left with a lingering issue called what?
Mono.
Mono. And if you get rid of that later afterwards, you may have chronic fatigue syndrome. Yeah. So no fun with that particular disorder. And then finally, we've all probably experienced leukocytosis. If you've had an infection anywhere in your body, your white blood cell count will elevate, and the elevated count is to help fight that infection. If it's a bacterial infection, what population of white blood cells do we expect to see increase?
Neutrophils.
What else? Monocytes. Yep. So we may see increased white blood cell populations anytime an infection pops up. I didn't cover any thrombocyte or platelet disorders. You may have heard of hemophilia before, but we're focusing mainly here on the red and the white blood cell disorders. All right, so looks like we're ready to move on to blood clotting. Do y'all have any questions so far? Okay, so the term hemostasis sounds really familiar. It sounds a lot like homeostasis, right? Okay, so not to be confused, but you know, the goal here, of course, is to stop bleeding and to clot and coagulate our blood. There's three steps here: vascular spasms, platelet plug formation, and coagulation. And if it's not a severe cut, then we can typically stop bleeding in about 3 to 5 minutes' time. So let me take you through the first step of blood clotting, which is called a vascular spasm. The very first thing your vessel's going to do when it's been cut is it's going to kind of constrict and spasm. This is an attempt to stop what? Blood flow. Yeah, we don't want blood to continue to flow through that area and be lost. And I just want to make this point that you could be bleeding internally and never know it. We, of course, are aware of external bleeds. We can see that. But whether it's an internal or an external bleed, the vessel's going to squeeze, constrict, and prevent blood flow and blood loss. So there are chemicals like serotonin that induce blood vessel spasming that helps to make that vessel tighten up. Now, we can assist this by doing what to a really bad cut? Put pressure on it, right. So putting pressure mimics the step of vascular spasms. Almost as soon as the vessel begins to spasm, we see platelets traveling through the blood begin to cling to the inside lining of your vessel. Normally, should platelets cling to vessels? What would be the problem if they did? Blood clots, yeah. So the only time the platelet should cling to the inside of your vessel is when you've got damage done to it. And you'll notice here, these platelets are clinging to some portions of those cells. They're actually clinging to collagen fibers that are hanging down. And so they swing on. I kind of have this mental image of platelets like Tarzan. They grab onto those collagen fibers, they cling to it, and then they holler for help. So they release a chemical. Again, it's serotonin, and that promotes that platelet plug formation. Ashley, did you have a question?
So the serotonin tells the platelets to attach the collagen fibers.
Right.
Without that serotonin, they don't, right?
It's going to be less likely for them to come because it's kind of like a help call that says, hey, come, hey, cling.
Like positive feedback?
It is positive feedback. Yeah, it sure is. So yeah, one of the very few instances of positive feedback here, but you're right, platelet plug formation is a great example of that. You know, if you take a piece of tissue paper, like Kleenex or toilet paper from your house, and you slap it onto a wound, and you walk around the house and forget about it, 10 minutes later, somebody says, what's going on? You know, what you got there? And you say, oh, I cut myself. And then you rip off that paper. What are you ripping off? Platelets, right. And then what happens? You bleed again, right. So platelets will cling to pretty much anything. They love to cling to, you know, basically whatever they can to form a platelet plug. They'll even cling to your clothes and form a plug against your clothing. You know, Band-Aids and bandages and gauze have a chemical inhibitor on there that prevents them from clinging. But, you know, we've probably all pulled off a Band-Aid that has a platelet plug still stuck to it. So it's not a perfect science, but it's meant to prevent that clotting, that sticking process. Okay, so the FAMCI step is actually the third and final step of blood clotting, and this is called coagulation. Let me emphasize, this is not agglutination. Okay, what was agglutination? Yeah, antibodies fighting and attacking antigens. It totally is not this process. This process of coagulation involves making your blood turn from a liquid to a gel, literally clotting your blood and clumping it up. There's actually 10 different factors that are required to make blood clotting occur. You know, we're not going to go through all those 10 factors here in class. What makes it a nightmare is they named them 1 through 10 in the order they were discovered, but the sequential process is not numerical. So it may be like factor 1, then factor 6, then factor 3, then factor 8, and it's just a nightmare. But nonetheless, a lot of those medications on the market that prevent blood clots, like Xarelto, Eliquis, Pradaxa, those kinds of things, they all prevent some portion of that factor process from being converted. What we're interested in is this, making a clot. A clot is called a thrombus, and we use an ingredient in your bloodstream called thrombin to make that clot. Thrombin is going to help to interact with fibrinogen. We talked about this one in class the other day. Fibrinogen is an inactive form of fibrin. All it takes is the interaction of thrombin and fibrinogen to make a mesh-like fiber called fibrin. I know I said complete Greek to you, right?
Please translate.
Okay, so the goal here is to make a net, kind of like a fishing net or a volleyball net. And the name of that net is called fibrin. Okay, that's our end goal. When you get fibrin, you can now form a coagulated clot. And that means that we now have a gel-like blood instead of a liquid for blood in that particular location. Anyone still need the slide? Good to go? Okay. So this is fibrin. This net that you see in the picture is fibrin. It helps to make the blood turn from a liquid to a gel, and it effectively stops the bleeding because it traps those red blood cells from leaving. And this is a really awesome picture. It's a real picture of fibrin forming a mesh network around those red blood cells. So they're literally trapped. It's like spider webs. They're not going anywhere. This is now what we want to accomplish. This is coagulation, and this effectively turns your blood from a liquid to a gel. So, you know, I don't know if you check out your scabs or if you did as a kid, you know, when it's in that healing process and it's still kind of wet and mushy, that's this stuff. It's coagulation. And when this dries out, it becomes a hardened scab. And eventually, that hardened scab falls off and goes away. And that's because we no longer need that in place, the blood vessel has grown back and knitted itself up. Okay, so if you pull this PowerPoint, there's a pretty good video. It's a several minute long video that you may want to watch. It's a good one that takes you through the steps of coagulation and blood clotting. All right, so we're about halfway down the page at this point. And so I'd like to talk to you about what our bodies require, rather, for making a blood clot effective. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this. Good to go. Okay. So in order to clot our blood, we actually need some ingredients. We need vitamin K, which we can get from green leafy vegetables, and we also need calcium. And so if you don't have enough blood calcium available, where do you get it from?
Bones,
good. Using which hormone?
Parathyroid.
Parathyroid, yeah. And if you can't get it from your bones, you have two other locations. Your intestines or your kidneys. Yeah, intestines and kidneys. Yep, so we can always pull it back in from forming urine that way. Yep. Just to kind of share with you an interesting link here, you know, some people take long-term courses of antibiotics. Antibiotics kill the bacteria, especially those bacteria in your gut. And the bacteria in your gut actually help us to absorb vitamin K from these green leafy vegetables. So if you take a long-term course of antibiotics and you don't absorb that vitamin K, what do you think happens to your blood clotting mechanism?
Decreases.
So how do we know by looking at somebody that they're having trouble clotting their blood? Maybe bleeding, maybe have nosebleeds. Yep. They may have, you know, places like bruises where they are not able to effectively clot. So some warning signs may pop up when we've got somebody who has a vitamin K deficiency. They may have an inability to fully clot that blood.
Would it affect the menstruation of a woman too?
I don't know what the direct effect would be there. Because we don't necessarily want that to clot. What happens with the menstruation is the vessels in the endometrium, they kink and then they die and then the lining falls off because it has no direct blood supply anymore. So I'm not sure that vitamin K would directly influence that as much as it would like nosebleeds, for instance. I'll look and see. That's an interesting connection. Yeah. I just wanted to mention that, you know, if we do plan to store blood, say maybe we've received some for transfusions, then we may make it into what's called blood serum. You'll notice that blood serum doesn't have blood cells. And very importantly, we may take out the fibrinogen if we're going to store that blood. A lot of blood bags, though, nowadays have some type of chemical in there that helps to prevent fibrinogen from converting into fibrin. So why is it important that we don't let fibrinogen convert to fibrin? Coagulation, right. How long would it take for your bag of donated blood to coagulate?
No. 3 to 5 days.
3 to 5 minutes.
Minutes.
Yep, 3 to 5 minutes. So that'd be a lot of work for nothing, right? Just checking to see if y'all need this slide. Okay. So we know the clot is called a thrombus. And the clot is effective until that blood vessel has grown back and knitted itself shut. At that point, we don't need the clot anymore, so we undergo a process called fibrinolysis. What does lysis tell us?
It
breaking down, splitting, right? So it's now the body's job to get rid of that clot, to remove it, because if left in place, it can block blood flow. And probably worse yet, if it breaks free and starts to float, it's now called what? Embolism. Yep, so we don't want embolisms on the move, so we want to destroy this clot, break it down. So fibrinolysis is going to help us to degrade the clot, prevent it from staying either stationary in the vessel or preventing it from being on the move. Either way, we don't want it to persist. All right, so on your worksheet, you've got a blank there for a thrombus and an embolus, and then one more question that says, how are thrombi and emboli related to fibrinolysis? Yeah, because we're trying to prevent, thrombi and emboli from persisting, and so if you continue to have them persist in the vessel, then that means fibrinolysis was not complete. So you could say simply that they are failures of fibrinolysis. If you fail to fully, break down that blood clot, you're going to continue to have those clots hang around. So you could say they are failures of fibrinolysis. So people with heart conditions, perhaps, arrhythmias, can form clots, and those clots can be ejected from the heart. And one of the common places for those clots to travel is to the lungs or to the brain. So, there are medications out there, these blood thinners, so to speak, that help to prevent these clots from being formed in the first place and hopefully prevent them from hitting vital organs like the heart, the lungs or the brain. We call these kinds of medications blood thinners, but actually that's not a true description for what they do. They don't actually make your blood less viscous. They simply prevent some part of that coagulation cascade. So an anticoagulant is really a more descriptive term, but everybody calls them blood thinners. We actually make our own. We've got heparin made by some of our white blood cells. In fact, basophils make heparin. So we do have our own built-in blood thinner. But sometimes that's not enough. We know that aspirin is an effective blood thinner or anticoagulant. There are others on the market that have been around for a number of years, like warfarin and Coumadin. And there's a whole new class of anticoagulants out nowadays, like Eliquis, Xarelto. There's a whole bunch of them. You may have seen them if you watch television, and they advertise themselves constantly. All right, so just wanted to make sure that we got down to the bottom of that page. And you know what? We are back full circle. What kind of questions do y'all have?
So many.
At least the test isn't Tuesday, so we're not pushed for time. Would you guys like to do a little bit of heart just to help you out for lab?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, did that sound too much?